The Guardian.
Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of unintentional death in the United States by far. More people are dying from drug overdoses today than from gun homicides and motor vehicles combined.
Opioid addiction has long been a problem in the US, but now there are concerns that the problem is spreading across the pond to the UK.
The doctor wants to help you. The doctor doesn't want to send you away still hurting. So they prescribe those drugs, and that can be the first step, if you like.
So it was just as simple as phoning up the surgery, getting your request, and there it was at your chemist, ready to pick up.
How long did your addiction last for, would you say?
On and off, near on 20 years.
Given the dangers of opioids, should they be prescribed so frequently? And what can we do to curb the looming crisis? I'm Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hi, Nikki, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can hear quite a lot of background noise as well.
It's on loudspeaker and I don't know how to turn it off.
Nikki Harry is a recovering opioid addict. We called her while she was at work and she popped out into the corridor to chat to us about her experiences.
So you don't get a buzz from it, but what you do get addicted to is that feeling of being on a pink fluffy cloud. So that feeling of tranquility, of your stress going away, the pain disappearing, that washing machine head that you have where everything's running around at 100 miles an hour in your head, that stops, and that's what becomes addictive.
How did addiction begin for you?
It started when I was in my early teens and I was struggling with knee problems. It didn't go away. And eventually my parents took me to see a consultant and I ended up having surgery. And it was after the surgery that I was put on low painkillers. I didn't realise at the time how addictive it was. I wasn't reliant on them at the time, but as I ended up having more knee surgeries and more complications, the dosage got higher, and that's when I became addicted.
In the US, the opioid epidemic is believed to have begun with prescriptions of the drugs. In 1991, there were 76 million opioid prescriptions. By 2011, there were 219 million, nearly three times as many. And now there are signs of the same trend in the UK.
Hi, so I'm Leslie Colvin. I'm Professor of Pain Medicine at the University of Dundee.
Chronic pain professor Leslie has recently published some work looking at the drugs in Scotland.
One of the things that we were very surprised at was that when we looked, focused in on one of the years, 2012, one in five, about 20% of the Scottish population, were prescribed some form of opioid. Now, that was a mixture of weak and strong opioids, but all prescription opioids. And we were really very surprised at the extent of that.
That's an extraordinary figure. What is driving that rise?
That's an interesting question. We also know that chronic pain is very common. So about the same proportion, about one in five of the Scottish population, will suffer from chronic pain at some point during their life.
What are the actual causes of the chronic pain people are reporting? Does it tend to be that they have muscle weakness, which is then giving rise to issues in their back or what have you?
There's a range of problems, but we know from a recent study that was published in The Lancet, the Global Burden of Disease study, is that low back pain is the number one cause of disability in the world. And that applies in this country as well. Musculoskeletal pain problems are very significant problems of chronic pain and long-standing disability. We also see other types of pain that can be extremely difficult to manage, such as neuropathic pain. So that's pain related to nerve injury. People who have neuropathic pain have an even worse quality of life than other types of chronic pain. And indeed, on one quality of life measure, 16% of patients with neuropathic pain rated their quality of life as worse than death, which is pretty miserable.
Is chronic pain itself something that's on the rise, or is it something that's been there as a pretty constant background that we are now seeing this opioid prescription rise against because those opioids are just becoming more readily available, more readily prescribed?
I think there's a number. It's complex, and there are a number of factors. So yes, chronic pain is increasing because chronic pain increases as you get older, and we live in an aging society. So there are more people with chronic pain. I think the other thing is that in terms of cultural views about opioid prescribing for chronic pain, those changed possibly in the late 90s, where prior to that, we tended not to use opioids, strong opioids for chronic pain over a long period of time. Now, there were a number of new opioids became available at that point, different formulations. And there was also a big push from some of the pharmaceutical companies regarding the new preparations that they were marketing. And almost in parallel with that, there was, if you like, a push from the pain community to say, we use strong opioids for people who have very bad cancer pain. Why should we deny someone who has chronic pain a potentially good painkiller? So, if you like, there was a number of things that all coalesced around about the same time that led to a change, a very significant change in prescribing habits.
You know, I was put on a repeat prescription each time I came out of hospital. They give you like a month's worth till you get to your own GP. You see the GP after a month and they just put you on ongoing repeat prescription. So it was just as simple as phoning up the surgery, getting your request, and there it was at your chemist ready to pick up.
How long did your addiction last for, would you say?
On and off, near on 20 years.
Wow, okay. Nikki talks about her addiction beginning with a prescription. Is it common for prescriptions to turn into that kind of problem?
We don't actually know how many people who take an opioid-based painkiller then go on to develop dependence. We would call it dependence.
This is Dr. Sally Marlowe.
I'm based at King's College London, where I'm a researcher at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, but I'm also a curatorial advisor to Science Gallery London and their opening exhibition, Hooked, which is about addiction, needing, wanting, longing.
There's little data on how often an opioid prescription turns into a dependency, but Sally says this is not the only factor to consider when thinking about why or how someone can develop an addiction.
So some people have a genetic predisposition towards becoming addicted. Now, that doesn't mean that's deterministic, and if you inherit the genes, you're definitely going to become addicted if you take one tablet of codeine. But what it does mean is that you might need to be a bit more careful. We also know that really big structural factors like poverty and deprivation, discrimination, all play a part in why people become addicted. And that can be to alcohol or to cannabis or to cigarettes, but also to opioids, be it opioids on prescription or the street opioids that we think about, heroin, increasingly fentanyl. Addiction to those opioids, much, much more prevalent in areas where life's a bit rough, actually.
Flesh that out for us. How is it that those kinds of life factors, if you like, feed into someone becoming addicted to an opioid? Why would deprivation, why would being out of work or something feed into you becoming addicted to a painkiller in particular?
So as a human being, there's a really easy answer to that. If your life is rubbish, why wouldn't you want to take something to make it better? As a scientist, that answer can be unpicked a bit. So if we think about what an opioid is, it's a drug. It's a drug that does two things. It's what we call an analgesic. It kills pain, but it's also a euphoric. If you take one of these pills, you're going to feel better. You're going to feel better physically, but a byproduct is you're going to feel better emotionally. Now, if you discover that, you may not be able to decipher whether that feeling better is physical or psychological, mental. What's interesting, though, is as with lots of drugs of addiction, it's when you take a drug away that people really notice it. So you've got your prescription, and at the end of it, you feel rubbish. the brain is a very clever organ and plays tricks on us. And what it can do is tell us that actually the reason that we feel so awful is because we're still hurting. We may still be hurting psychologically, emotionally. We may not be physically hurting in the way that we think we are. Now, this isn't to say it's not real pain. It is real pain, and it's experienced as physical.
But these people can be experiencing genuine pain that causes them discomfort and hurt, maybe because of these other factors, other than some physical damage to their bodies, and maybe that'll be more apparent to them when they actually come off a drug that's been they've been prescribed to treat that pain.
So the first bit of your question, I think, again, I can't really answer that as a scientist. I think it's hugely philosophical because we don't yet have any data that's really robust. But yes, I do think that people can experience life as painful. And that, because life is painful for very, very many people. It's very easy for us sitting here in North London in this lovely studio to forget, you know, how difficult life can be. I think there's something for some people that a key way to be able to express the overall pain of life, and I stress again, I am not saying this as a scientist. So then if you go to a doctor, doctor, I hurt, you're able to label what you're feeling. The doctor wants to help you. The doctor doesn't want to send you away still hurting. What has the doctor got in their magic medicine bag? They have these extraordinary drugs that if you have got a physical pain will take that away, but they'll also make you feel better. So they prescribe those drugs, and that can be the first step, if you like.
It was interesting, a few years ago, maybe about 5 years ago, I was teaching GPs, and I asked them, how many of you here would prescribe opioids for chronic pain? And they all put their hands up. And then I said, how many of you are comfortable with that? And none of them put their hands up. So there was a mismatch between the behaviours of what they were doing in terms of prescribing and what they felt comfortable doing. And I think it's very difficult when you see someone with severe chronic pain that's impacting on their daily life, day to day, to say, actually, I can't give you anything to make it better. Because, you know, as GPs and doctors, that's what we're trained to try and do.
Of course, only a fraction of those prescribed opioids will go on to become addicts. But for those who do become dependent, like Nikki and thousands of others, the implications can be far-reaching.
It had a massive impact on my life towards the end. I mean, it got to a point where I couldn't function, I couldn't focus, I was isolating from everybody, I was withdrawing, and I didn't understand what these symptoms were, what these pains were, the leg shaking, the cramping, the flu-like symptoms. And it just got to a point where my friends and family say, you're always ill, what's the matter with you? And I would just go to bed at night crying because I actually didn't know what was wrong with me.
You know, addiction is a miserable way of life. Your whole life becomes centered around finding the drug that you're addicted to, getting it, taking it. It costs money, people commit crimes, relationships fall apart, people lose their jobs. Addiction in and of itself is a hideous thing. Opioids, as well as being an analgesic, a painkiller, and a euphoric, they also suppress respiratory function. So when we talk about overdose and people dying from overdose, what's usually happened is they've taken too many pills and actually they've stopped breathing. So, you know, in terms of medical complications, it doesn't get much worse than death.
After the break, we'll be asking, is there a way to stop this worrying trend of dependency? And we ask, should we be prescribing these drugs at all?
I would say we have to trust our GPs to be able to prescribe.
I'll be back in a moment after this short break.
Last year, The Guardian tracked all the deaths of young people due to knife crime and explored the themes that emerged in an award-winning series called Beyond the Blade.
Why are they carrying a knife in an area where they know people but they feel that they have to acquit themselves from other people?
We saw many people suffering, but we also saw many fighting back.
We've got to start looking at how we talk and how we generalise and how we categorise just ordinary people that are poorer than other people or people who don't have as much as other people.
For this new series, journalists from The Guardian travelled to Bristol, Birmingham and Croydon in South London to listen to some of those people.
Society tends to look down at young people once they've made a wrong choice, and what we're saying by that is that we're writing them off.
And rather than report on their conversations, we let them speak for themselves.
When I come out of jail, I'd never been praised before. I'd turned my life around, and when I come out and got praised for the work that I was doing, I thrived.
That gap needs to be built up a bit sooner, you know, as opposed to, yeah, just waiting to hear from me, because I'm waiting to hear from the next generation as well. So we're all waiting and there's no like action happening.
If families are fractured, that has an impact on a young person. If a father and a mother get divorced, that has an impact on our young people. And I think the only way they know how to make people sit up and say, listen, there's a real problem going on here, is by violence.
To listen to all three episodes, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or subscribe by searching Beyond the Blade on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we looked at why opioid prescriptions are on the rise and what role pain might play. That's both physical and emotional pain. We asked why a doctor might write out a prescription for these drugs when they're so addictive. We talked about how doctors feel trapped. They want to relieve someone's suffering. They've dedicated their careers to doing just that. But they feel uncomfortable prescribing opioids because of their potential effects. So what needs to be done to remedy this situation and to curb the looming crisis? Treatment is the first step to help those already addicted. Here's addiction expert Sally Marlowe again.
For opioids specifically, we've got two types of treatment. We've got pharmacological treatments. So we might use methadone. What methadone is like, it's like nicotine replacement. So it irons out the highs and the lows, which down the road, the theory is that it makes it easier for you to quit completely. And actually, there's a lot of evidence to show that methadone does lead people to quit. The problem is that some people stay on methadone for a very, 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 very long time. And then you've got to ask yourself, is that okay? Now, for some people, I would say absolutely, yeah, that is okay. But I think some people probably get lost in the system because it's easier. What we also have, though, is we have all sorts, a whole basket of talking cures, if you like. One of the things which is really, really effective with addiction is peer support and group work, where you feel like you're not the only one. Other people have the same problem and everybody's talking about that problem. The difficulty, if you're a middle-aged, middle-class housewife who's addicted to prescription painkillers, if your treatment regime is methadone and group therapy with a group of people who perhaps are homeless or hostel dwellers who've been using street heroin for very, very many years, who possibly have an alcohol problem tied in with it, it might be very difficult for you to conceptualise yourself as an addict, if you like, with all the connotations of that word. it's not to say that your addiction is different. All addictions are different. Of course they are. There's individual variability, but addiction is addiction. So we run into problems when it comes to treating this group that are addicted to painkillers, because there's a reticence to enter that type of the treatment which is freely available. And of course, the way we treat people for addiction in this country is it's all cheap as chips. What's the easiest, cheapest way we can do it? And that means one size fits all. And actually what we know about addictions is what works is when things are tailored.
Tell me about your path to recovery. How did that begin? When did that begin?
So that was basically my family, my friends did an intervention on me. One of my sons was best friends with my best friend's son, and he was showing concerns about me. And I think my friends already had an inkling that something was wrong. They weren't sure what it was. They knew I took painkillers. They didn't know to what extent. And two of my best friends literally had to climb up onto the dustbins outside my house and bang on my bedroom window. I was so out of it, I didn't even hear the doorbell. And they sat with me and I just said, I just feel ill. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm very manipulative, very secretive. And then later on that day, about five of my friends turned up. And then I realized that they were actually driving me to see a psychiatrist who did an assessment. And he said, you are absolutely in the throes of addiction. And then the following Monday, I was admitted into rehab, where I was admitted for a 28-day residential program. I was put on a medical tapering and detox. And, you know, there was a lot of humility in rehab because I finally understood what all these problems were, where they were all coming from, how it was happening.
Given the problems that we know from the US, from the UK, from other countries, we know these problems exist with opioids. Should we be prescribing them?
Opioids work in the short term and are an extremely effective painkiller. And if you're hurting, you might want them. You might really want them. You might actually need them.
But that shouldn't be defined or restricted to hospital use, for example.
It's a good question. I would say we have to trust our GPs to be able to prescribe. I would say there's work to do to educate GPs. And remember, GPs have 7 or 8 minutes per patient. You know, again, we're back to this lowest common denominator stuff. This is about systems. This isn't about people getting it wrong. This is about systems getting it wrong. I do think, though, that what we all need to be aware of, GPs and the general public, is that for long-term back pain, for example, there are studies that show that these drugs are no better than placebo. So the fact that we now have evidence that for some of those longer-term conditions, that these drugs don't work, and actually you're better off with a sugar pill, we really need to be doing more on that.
Today, Nikki is 7 years clean, and she now helps people who are in the position she was once in, working for an organisation called UCAT.
That's UK Addiction Treatment Group. We own 7 rehabs, and we are sort of the main office for admissions. So people will do some research on the internet and call us, and we'll give them the best advice that we can, whether it be through the local drug and alcohol services or, you know, worst case scenario, going into rehab. Just advising them of what options are there for them.
Thank you to Nikki Harry for sharing her experiences with us, and also to Leslie Colvin and to Sally Marlowe. The exhibition Sally mentioned is called Hooked at the Science Gallery in London. A link with more information can be found on our website, along with everything you've heard in the podcast. Just head over to theguardian.com/podcasts. Science Weekly is produced by Greya Jackson and presented by me, Ian Sample. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.